Okay. Hi, everybody. I am an alcoholic. My name is Dorothy Hardy. My sobriety date is November 10th, 2007. I have a home group. It is the Happy Destiny Group. Meets on Mondays at 7. St. Andrew's Methodist, one of those, church off of Bridge Road. If you're ever down in Suffolk on a Monday night, come by and visit us. I do have a sponsor, and she does absolutely know that she is sponsoring me. I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I really love the fact that you read page 29. It's when I first came back in the week of the Friday after I came in. I came in on a Saturday night, and I came in on a Saturday, and the Friday afterward, I heard somebody say, "Don't forget the stories." And I've heard people say, "It's just the first 164 and all that sort of thing. But what I liked about the stories was that it doesn't beat you over the head to find a power greater than yourself. It just shows you how to get there. I ended up in Virginia again because I was born at Portsmouth Naval Hospital in 1965. My dad was in the Navy. And by the time I was 5, I lived in Virginia, California, New Jersey. I think that's it. And then we moved to Illinois. And that's where my mom and dad got divorced in 1971. And it was close to where my mom and my dad were from. They were from Michigan, right around here. And it's Ionia, Michigan, where the biggest claim to fame was they had 7 prisons from maximum security to limited, not too bad. And I grew up in Illinois and Michigan, and I had stuff happen. My parents got divorced. My parents got divorced in February. Their divorce was final. She remarried on April 2nd of that same year. I got a stepfather. My dad, like I said, was in the Navy, and it was difficult for him to be part of our lives. So he let my stepfather adopt my sister and I. And, I could say that one of the excuses to all my excuses as to why I'm an alcoholic. And, he was a bit of a jerk. And, he did his best he could, just like my mom. They both had trouble with alcohol. I'm not going to tell them that they're drunks, but they're not alcoholic. I don't know. But they have had problems with alcohol. My mom and my stepdad, they were married until like 1987. But alcohol has always been a thing in whoever is my stepfather in my mother's life. First time I drank, I think it was at a family reunion when I was about 5 or 6 years old. That little kid that's toddling around. There's beers sitting on people's tables or chairs, or some with cigarette butts in them, some without. And, just taking sips off of stuff. And the thing is, for me, I was the kid that, you go to the playground, remember those metal merry-go-round things? And I wanted to go faster. I always wanted to go faster and faster. Even when I fell off, got a bloody nose, scraped up my knees, you know, all the consequences that come in your life, in my life, when I just do what I want. And I mean, it was a pretty steady story of my life. I mean, by the time I was in high school, I think we lived in 5 different places. I went to one school for kindergarten and first grade, went to another school for second grade, went to another school for 3rd to 5th grade, went to junior high school. And then, you know, I was one of those latchkey kids. It was the 80s, 70s and 80s. Some of you might remember that. And I was the one, you know, I remember one time we lived in an apartment complex and my mom worked. She worked full time. They did what they had to do. And my sister and I decided to play hooky from elementary school. And the thing is, we stayed in the house, kept all the curtains closed, barely turned on the TV, and just kept on looking out the window. And we still got busted because the lady who managed the apartment complex, because she always used to see us walk past her office in the morning when we were walking to school. And she called my mom. We tried to lie. And, you know, I told my mom, well, Debbie was sick, so she didn't want to go to school and we didn't want to bother you at work. And I always tried to lie, make it sound good enough to believe. And I always failed. So that's, you know, that's pretty much the way my life went. And also when I got to junior high school, you know, latchkey kid, above the refrigerator was the liquor cabinet. And I learned how to make tea and water look like scotch a little bit. And so I could drink a little bit of it and, you know, just add a little water to the vodka. And nobody's going to notice, you know. So I became the mixologist of the our unit, our apartment, 6-unit entrance. And, you know, so that was like 12, 13 years old. And it helped me not be in me, you know, make me feel good in my own skin and not have to deal with all the others. Because I developed kind of early. I mean, I was in 6th grade, 5'7", size 10 foot, big mouth, and I got myself in trouble a lot. I was the class clown, and I just, you know, if you're laughing with me, you're not laughing at me. So I just did what I had to do. I started gaining weight, and I had some stuff happen, one of my stepfathers. And, you know, it's a good protective thing sometimes to gain weight and then you're not as noticeable. So, you know, I just went on and on. My freshman year, was going into freshman year in high school. And I actually had that situation where my parents moved and didn't tell us. And I went to summer camp and we lived one place. And when I came back from summer camp, we had moved. And I was going to be going to a high school that I didn't know anybody. I was going to, you know, my school, I got finally in with some friends. I was getting to know everybody. I was going to be on the swim team. I was semi-popular. And next thing I know, I'm starting school where I know nobody. And it just so happened to be the rival school to the high school I was supposed to go to. So, you know, I was like, oh no, I was embarrassed. I ate lunch for the first month in the girls' bathroom. And then I found my people. and a bunch of dorks and outcasts like myself. But I was still the class clown. I started drinking more. But I also, what I thought was funny was I drank a lot. But I was also part of the peer counseling. You know, we called it Snowball. I lived out, like I said, I lived outside of Chicago in Illinois, and where Jim Belushi was from. And there was the big push to, you know, don't drink, don't do drugs, all that stuff. And so I was a peer counselor for others who had problems with drugs and alcohol. Mostly it was a connection to know where the best parties were. So, you know, that was pretty cool. And I didn't have a lot of consequences yet. After discussions with my mom in the past 15 years, found out I was a holy terror. I was horrible. I used to sneak out of the house. We lived in one-story homes, so it was real easy to get out of the house. I didn't have to worry about breaking anything, at least not climbing out of a window. You know, I was a terror to my little sister, who she would tell me, I'm going to tell mom, I'm like, go ahead. And I don't care. I don't care. I do what I want. That was my biggest thing, was I do what I want. And I don't care what you think about it. And so my sister was terrified of me. As I got older, my mom became terrified of me. And then my senior year in high school, I don't know how many. See, here's the thing. I turned 18 my end of my sophomore year. I was held back a year because I was born in December, you know, all that stuff. And so I lived in Illinois, close enough to Wisconsin. And when the drinking age changed in Illinois to 21, it stayed 18 in Wisconsin. It was an hour and 20 minute drive. So this was no problem to drive all the way up here for me. It was only 3 hours. So it was no problem to drive up to Wisconsin to be the getter of all alcoholic beverages. I got the kegs, I got the bottles, I got the handles, I got whatever was needed. So I became really popular. And the last party I had at my house, my parents, my dad, my stepdad, and my mom were separated. They were getting divorced. My mom had a new boyfriend. And my stepdad came to the house after my party, and he called my mom and he's like, you will not believe what she did this time. I mean, I was like, but I put all the furniture in one place and nobody could get to it. Only problem is there's people in my mom's bed. There's people in other beds. There's people passed out. There's broken bottles, you know? And, you know, that's pretty much how my life was. When I graduated, I finally got back in touch with my dad, and he was stationed in Hawaii. And that was my first real big geographical. As I graduated high school, my mom's like, I'm going to kill you. You need to go stay with your dad for a little while. And I said, okay, this is great. And I got there in September, like September 5th. And by December 1st, the day before my birthday, my stepmother was telling my dad, it's either her or me. So I got to spend my birthday in Hawaii. And then I was sent home. And then my mom's like, I don't care what you do, but you will go to work every day and you will pay me rent. She made me pay her rent. And then, you know, I did that. I drove up to Wisconsin almost every night, and I'd get home at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, get up at 5. And we'd ride, we worked together too. And we'd ride into work. And because I was like, you said, I don't care what you do, as long as you go to work in the morning. So I went to work every morning until I screwed that up again. And she kicked me out. And I became homeless for, well, you know, technically homeless. I always had somewhere to land. I had friends that allowed me to lay, sleep on their couches. I was hopping from couch to couch. And mind you, I graduated in 1984. I am doing all this in 1985 and 1986. And then my grandmother and grandfather, who were up in Michigan, they're like, you just need to come live with us, honey. We love you. And I said, ooh, another sucker. And I took advantage. But the thing is, I found my first fiance of a total of five because I take hostages. And he was going to join the Navy and we were going to get married. And I'd only known him for like a couple weeks. And we moved in together. He joined the Navy. I went to live with my dad again. And, you know, I was a good girl now because I'm going to be a married woman. And of course, I screwed that up. And that's pretty much the timeline of all that. I was showing Rebecca because she hasn't seen pictures of all my fiancés. But like the first one was Tim. And then the next one was Mike. He was a manager in a shoe store. And I was a worker in a shoe store, and it was a match made in heaven. And he was going to take care of me too. But I was going to help him out too, because he lived with his parents and it was a very mutual relationship. And then I realized he was just as crazy as I was. And we broke up after he kind of made me drive up to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee with him, because I was trying to break up with him. And he forced me to ride with him. And my dad's like, please, Mike, bring her home. And, you know, we broke up. And then in September of 1987, I met the love of my life. And I don't know if anyone here has been in the Navy, got stationed at Great Lakes, anything like that. But there's this road called Sheridan Road. And my girlfriend, who was pregnant, she was about 8 months pregnant and she couldn't sleep. So we're driving and these guys, these pretty cute guys driving next to us. We waved, we said hi, and they happened to have a case. And we stopped and drank together. And the driver was really cute. And he looked like John Cusack, the early years. And I found the one. And we spent every day together. Mind you, that was the end of September. By November 18th, we were married. And then I found out the reason he was kind of driving around, not in a club or a bar, was because he was on restriction because he had been smoking pot. And so he, you know, whatever. And then he got kicked out of the Navy. And I ended up in Ticonderoga, New York. I don't know if anyone knows where Ticonderoga is, but it is about 100 miles south of the Canadian border. It's a very small town. I grew up outside of Chicago. So that was like culture shock. And mind you, my drinking has been steadily getting worse. The other thing was, Joe, I'm going to say this, is drugs are part of my story, but I am not an addict. I usually did drugs that made you stay awake. Some of you, like I said, from the 80s might remember what those might be. I did think I was fancy because I did crystal. I just forgot the meth part of it. And cocaine keeps you awake long enough to drink till you're sober and then drunk again. So that's my drug use. But my first husband, he was an addict, an alcoholic, and a dealer. And it's always so much easier when you don't have to pay for your stuff. So I ended up, I was not pregnant. And I always clarify this. I was not pregnant when I got married. We got married in November. My son was born in September. So you can do the math. And even though a lot of people were going, are you pregnant? No, I'm not. I'm the first one in many generations. Thank you. And the thing is, I hated Ticonderoga. It was a little teeny tiny town. I didn't like tiny towns. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to get out of Ticonderoga. Well, if you don't smoke pot for 30 or so days, you can join the Navy. And that's what I did. And I went to boot camp at 25 years old with a son who was a year and a half old. I was kind of unusual. You know, a lot of the women were 18, 17 years old. I was not the oldest, but I was the second oldest in boot camp. And because I had a child, they made me the laundry petty officer. So the thing is, it's all about manipulations and making my life easier. And when you're the laundry petty officer now, boot camp in 1990, the men and women were not together. We were separated. And for some ungodly reason, when you're at your absolute worst, you want to find the love of your life in boot camp. So I got all the hookups. You know, somebody polished my shoes. Somebody made my rack for me. I didn't have to stand watches, and I could pass notes with their laundry petty officer. The funny thing about boot camp also is if you do good enough in boot camp, you get back then, because it was in Florida, you could go to Universal Studios towards end of graduation time. And they gave us very specific rules. And it was, do not smoke and do not drink. And I said, okay. And then I got off the bus. Laundry petty officer and I, we were both married, both had kids, all that stuff. We bummed a cigarette from somebody and went to one of the locations where you could get a beer. And that's what we did. And we had a great day. So, you know, once again, I do what I want. I don't care what you want. And I went in as an undesignated airman, which is kind of stupid. But I got a job when I was in boot camp, and it was in Meridian, Mississippi. And it was a short school, but my husband hated Ticonderoga too. So I brought him with me. It was only a 7-week school, which is usually you don't bring your family with you. And I brought him with me, and I brought my son with me. And, you know, I got my orders, got stationed at Norfolk Naval Station. And mind you, this was January 1991. I don't know if anyone remembers what happened in January of 1991, but it was the first Desert Storm. And I got stationed on a ship that fortunately was coming back from, you know, from over there. And my first 3 day underway, I got incredibly sick. I've never been sick. I've never been seasick. Turns out when you take your husband to your A school, you can get pregnant. So I got stationed off the ship, and I had all these dreams. I was going to do things. I was going to be the first female Mass Chief Petty Officer of the Navy. I was going to do this. I was going to do that. And I was pregnant at a command that I was miserable. My husband, in my eyes, was a jerk. And I had two kids. And I was drinking. I was drinking because you can't smoke pot anymore in the Navy. And life got super lifey. And by 1993, my husband and I, on Valentine's Day, 1993, I told my husband that I loved him dearly, but I was not in love with him anymore. And I said, I think we need to get separated. And he said, okay. And he took the kids up to Ticonderoga again. And I was by myself from February to July. And I was out of control. I was crazy. I was, like they say in the big book. And in June of 1993, my grandmother, who had had a stroke about 6 years prior to that, she died. And my ship was just getting ready to go underway. We were going to be going to Halifax, great party town from what I've heard. And, but I had to go to my grandmother's funeral and everything. And then once they left Halifax, they were going to Fleet Week in Boston. And, so I went up to, Michigan again. I blew up almost every family relationship that I had there. My aunt, who I am named after, I am her namesake. We look a lot alike. I drove her car drunk, her van drunk, with her children in the van with me. And I hit one of her neighbors. And I forgot to tell her. And yeah, that happened. And I had to wait 10 days before I could meet my ship in Boston. So I got to Boston and I was not sober at all, except the Friday before we left, Friday, July 8th. By this time, I've got lots of really good male friends. And I had my, last night we were there, I had my chief and my division officer who came to our birthing. We're all getting ready, you know, getting all cute, putting on our uniforms. You know, guys aren't the only ones who they like to see in a uniform and in our whites and everything. And mind you, my division officer did not like me. I was a snot. I was an absolutely horrible person. And my chief and my division officer came in and she told me, we just got a message. Your father-in-law has died in a car accident. And she gave me the Red Cross message, basically threw it at me. And I told her after I read it, that's not my fill in your best expletive, father-in-law, that's my husband. And that was the first time I had not drank that evening in probably 6 months that night. And I went up to New York. My brother-in-law almost killed me because he blamed me because we had gotten separated. And if he wasn't there, he wouldn't have died. Mind you, he was an alcoholic and an addict. And, you know, I'm not blaming him, but I know the circumstances, been there, done that. And that's when I got my one and only up there. They call it a DWAI, driving while ability impaired. And I call it a DUI light. And mostly they said because my husband died, you know, that sort of thing. But probably if they would have breathalyzed me, I would have been way above the limit. And so in that week, also, my mother-in-law tried getting custody of my kids, you know, stupid stuff. But I came home with no skills whatsoever how to deal with life on life's terms. So, I mean, I could go into the drunk log, and I need to get sober soon. So, you know, that was 2 years from 1993 to 1995 where I barely was sober. My dad moved in with me because he was worried about my kids. I lived in base housing by that time. And then I couldn't stand my dad anymore. And then my sister moved in with me. So that seriously, my kids weren't raised by the wolf. That was me. And they even tried doing interventions in the van after church with me, all these crazy things. And then February 28th, 1995, there's this place down by us there was a place called Knickerbockers, and they had quarter draft night on Monday nights. So if you had a roll of quarters, you were good to go. And I went out at 7 o'clock at night, walked in the door to the house at 5:30 because my sister was living with me. And my daughter, who was 3 years old at the time, was at the bottom step of the stairs and said, "Mommy, where have you been?" So I went into, I had duty that day too. So I was so not fit for duty. And I went to my first class. She said, "Let's go up to medical." I was actually honest. And by March 20th, I was in the Navy's rehab, which was at the time called ARC. I was there for 5 weeks instead of four because still do what I want. And I just stopped drinking. And then life started getting better. I went through treatment. I didn't drink. People were starting to trust me. People were actually smiling to see me. My house was clean. That was amazing. And so I was going to meetings. I wasn't doing anything else, mind you. I was going to meetings. Finding my new husband, because I found one of them in treatment too. That was fiance number four. And we ended up not getting married, thank goodness. And, you know, I was going to meetings, doing all the things. I said I was an ANDA. I don't know if you guys use that phrase up here, but, you know, alcoholic and an addict. And so I went to NA too and all those things. And I met the new guy, but we were both sober and we were sitting across from each other. He had just gotten out of prison. He thought I was cute. I thought he was cute. He was a pretty decent guy. I was giving him rides to meetings because, you know, he didn't have a license. And so, you know, and I waited to marry him. We met in 1996. We didn't get married until 1998. Amazing. And, you know, we were doing all the things except steps, sponsorship, being of service. You know, the things that are recommended when you get sober. And so we had no basis. You know, no defense against the first drink. And we didn't drink for 10 years. You know, we're very hard-headed, both of us. And so April of 2005, he got all this work that he was doing. He's been with the same company on the first. He'll be celebrating 25 years. And they had him going up to Northern Virginia to do training. And he was the first one who was defenseless. And it was one of those, he thought, and I'm just sharing what he shares too, because we are at this point part of the same story. We have our own things, but we are part of the same story right now. And he said, if you think I'm an asshole now, sorry, just wait until you see me drinking. And I lied to myself saying, he's not drinking for 6 months. But I was getting madder and madder at him because I knew he was drinking, but he wasn't telling me the truth. So how dare you? And on, I think it was November 17th, 2005, I finally confronted him. And instead of saying, I'm going back to AA, I said, why the hell didn't she take me with you? And that started 2 years of incomprehensible demoralization. The first day there was, when I was drinking previously, there was this club called Papa's Pub. And it was like a biker bar and, you know, place you don't want to go. And I said, that's where I want to go. He goes, that's not where we're going. You are too white bread for that. And then we went to the Azalea Inn. And I remember that drink. It was a Captain and Coke. And I had a moment. But I got a case of the epits. And said, you know what? I can do this. I'm more mature now. I know where my problems lie. I know where I went wrong. I. There was no higher power in there anywhere. And the first week, because, you know, my daughter hadn't seen me take a drink since she was 3. That was 10 years. She was 13. My son, oh, and we made ourselves the Brady Bunch. I forgot to tell you. He had his 2 children he ended up with custody of. And we had my 2 children that I had no choice. And I love them dearly. I'm joking. So we were the Brady Bunch. And they hadn't seen us drinking in over 10 years. And so at first, we didn't drink in the house. We only drank in the garage. Mind you, it was November and it started getting cold and it's our house. And then we said, sat them down. We have something to tell you. We're drinking now again. If you happen to notice any problems, please say something to us. Mind you, they were 17, 15, and 13, making others responsible for our sobriety. And off to the races about 3 weeks later. And so on November 10th, 2007, like I could tell you all over again what it was like for those 2 years. All I'm gonna tell you, hell, it does not get better. For me, it did not get better. It only got worse. And I tried killing myself 3 times. So November 10th, I hit the bottom that I couldn't go any further down because that's called death. And I didn't want to die. And went home. I had such an emotional bottom. It was not pretty. And I ended up around us. We've got this place called the Easy Desert Club. And it's where a lot of people who are low bottom drunks pick up a white chip, you know, snot slinging, tears falling down your face, looking a mess. And we both did it. And then we went to another meeting that night, my buddy Rebecca there, that wasn't your home group yet, but you were going there. And what was kind of cool was there was a lady who remembered me the first time around. And I said, I'm back. And she goes, how did that work out for you? The worst words you're ever going to hear. How'd that work out for you? Oh, it was just a pleasure. Every day was a picnic. No. She looked at my face and she knew. And she was part of the reason why I started getting involved. My husband, it took him an additional 6 weeks to get back in for real. And I'm very grateful we're still together. We're getting ready to celebrate our 25th wedding anniversary in August. And we have seen each other at our very lowest. We've seen each other at our very highest. My children are now, 39, 38, 34, and 31.
Wow.
I have four grandchildren who have not seen me drunk, but they know I'm an alcoholic. My oldest granddaughter went to her first meeting when she was a week old. She just turned 12. But I came into AA, and what's fortunate, like I said, that one lady who was like, what are you going to do now? How'd that work out for you? What are you going to do now? I said, I guess I need to work the steps. And she goes, yeah, that's probably a good idea. And I didn't get a sponsor right away. I had to find the right one. I'm not sure I found the first right one, but I found the one that I needed at that time. And she took me through to step three, and which was what she was supposed to do. And what's funny, when I was in before, back in 1995, they made you get a temporary sponsor while you're in treatment. And I got my temporary sponsor, this lady. And what was really cool was that she was really cool. And she had a good amount of time. And it turns out, because Kenny had come back in to, you know, came in, and he was actually, we weren't going to the same meetings at the time because we thought it was better that way. Probably was. And he said, there's this lady that reminds me of that lady you were talking about when you got sober the first time. I'm like, really? He goes, yes. And her name's the same. I'm like, okay. And I went to that meeting, and I said, it's Jeannie. And I said, do you remember me? Because I am the most important person in the room. And she goes, yeah. Yeah. And I said, I'm back. And she goes, really? What are you doing? I said, I'm working the steps. Will you be my sponsor again? And then she said, sure, but you need to tell the person you're working with right now that you found a new sponsor. And I was like, can't I just walk away? But she made me be responsible. And that was one of those first lessons. So that took me about 2 months to tell the other woman that I got a new sponsor. And Jeannie wasn't talking to me yet. But I stayed with Jeannie probably the first 9 years that I came back into the rooms. We did the steps. It was funny. She asked me to drive her because she's a little bit older than me, not really that much, but she didn't like driving at night. And she had asked me to drive her to this meeting in Portsmouth, and we're talking. And I'm like, I tell people about how I, because in treatment, they made me do a autobiography to, which is all just a, I'm a bad girl, but I'm not going to do anything about it list. And I tell people how I mailed that to you and I never spoke to you again. And she goes, well, I'm glad you're at a year now because I need to tell you something. And I'm like, what's up? She goes, you know, I never got that. If that isn't a lesson in just letting go and letting God, I don't know what is. Because my mess was all out there somewhere. Somebody's got it. Could be something fun to read every once in a while. I don't know. But she never got it. So I'm like, so how important is it really? And so I, you know, those little God shots, so to speak, to take me out of my own way have happened a lot in my life. I got into service And that's how Billy knows me. I got into service practically the minute I came into the rooms. I was asked, we've got an intergroup in our area, Tidewater Intergroup. And I was less than a year sober. And the intergroup chair said, Dorothy, will you be the steering committee secretary? Okay. I will do anything you tell me to do. And I did. And so I became the steering committee chair after that. And then this one lady, and then I was like doing intergroup and general service, a little bit of both all the time. And then I went nuts because I wasn't holding on to that triangle, because it says recovery, unity, and service. You have to have all three pieces of that triangle to be balanced. And when you get unbalanced, you're unbalanced. And I lost my mind a little bit. I ended up with very short hair because that's how I do things. I cut it. And my sponsor said, we need to do some work. I'm like, yes, I think so. And then I was told by this lady, we call her Big Kathy. She said, Dorothy, you need to decide if you're going to be in local service or general service and stick with it. I said, okay, I'm going to be in general service because intergroups are crazy. They are crazy. And I'm already crazy enough. I don't need any of that. And so I became part of general service. I served as an alt GSR. And mind you, my husband and I, and one of my other litter mates, we all got sober around the same time. And we ended up in the same home group. That's the only meeting Kenny and I went to together. And we were going pretty steady. And it was a home group of one guy. And one day, the DCM of the Oceanfront who went to this meeting said, you three, come here. We're like, okay. He goes, this is now your home group. Here is the briefcase. Let Dick have some rest. Okay. Gave us the briefcase with over $600 in it that hadn't been distributed to anybody. And we all did every position available. So when I was in intergroup, I was in intergroup. When I was in general district, I was in district. One of us was then secretary treasurer of the actual group. And we took turns opening the meeting. And that was for 6 years. And it gave me a really good basis for being of service, being in recovery, and doing all the things you're supposed to do. I met this young lady right here. We have been friends since I got sober. We have had a major blowout and we're still really good friends, which is amazing to me. We didn't talk for 2 years. So, you know, one of us had to say, I regret what I did. And I think both of us did. Then I was asked to be GSR. And then the last meeting of the district for that year when things were rotating, somebody nominated me as secretary. I'm like, what the heck? And then next thing I know, I'm ADCM, DCM. And I've been at the state level. I've gone down to the state level because the group's the most important thing. But were it not for service, I probably wouldn't still be sober. Because sometimes when I am completely and utterly unavailable for my own recovery, I always got a commitment and service. I'm very grateful that I've been asked to serve for two rotations. And I'm really grateful I was asked to speak. I told my husband I was asked to speak and he goes, where? I said, Madison. He's from Virginia. And he's like, I don't know where that's at. And I had to tell him. He said, okay, have fun. You know, we've got a great relationship. Like I said, my children all like me, not just love me today. Because that's the important part. You know, sometimes you feel obligated to love your family. But I actually like my family today, and my family likes me. Like I said, my grandchildren have never seen me drunk. I can be there. I'm present in their lives today. In December, our youngest daughter, who has three children, had to move in with us. And we were thinking we were finally done with kids in the house. And I guess, you know, be careful what you wish for. But it's been a wonderful experience. And I want to share something, because when I was told that you read page 29, like I started when I spoke about the stories, that week, that first week I came back into the rooms, there's a story. I've got an old big book here. In on page 427, now it changed on me, and from the first time I got sober to the second time I got sober, that we were reading, and it's called Window of Opportunity. And I don't know if anyone knows that story, but it is one of my very favorite stories. And so I'm going to finish with this because it describes me to a T. I went to my first AA meeting with absolutely no idea what AA was about. I am from a large Irish Catholic family and have had several relatives in and out of the program. AA, like prison, was shameful. However, and it was never discussed. I also had no idea what alcoholism was. I remember a girlfriend once told me that her mother had a drinking problem, but she was not an alcoholic. Curious, I asked what the difference was. An alcoholic, she told me, is someone who needs to drink alcohol every day, even if it is only one drink. A person with a drinking problem does not have to drink every day, but once she starts, she cannot stop. By that definition, I was an alcoholic with a drinking problem. And like I said, it describes me to a T. So, like I said, I appreciate y'all asking me to be here, and I got sober in time and everything. So, have a wonderful evening. Thanks.